All right, good morning, everybody. Since we're kind of a smaller group, we'll adapt a little bit. I had expected maybe guys who weren't, I'm thinking of the right word here, as experienced as you guys are. So we'll adjust the presentation just a little bit. But it's going to be something a little different. Warner knows that when I give presentations, it has a tendency to be a little Monty Python. Now for something totally different. But a little bit about myself. As he said, I'm a certified Carnegie trainer, leadership training for managers. We'll talk a little bit about that. I'm an adjunct professor of business leadership at Olivet Nazarene University. I teach leadership online. I actually have my own leadership advising business, and why that is will become actually part of the presentation. I do a lot of mobile for banking. Product managing right now for HP. HP has a lot of great products, but what we found out is that when we went to banks, it was kind of like the banks came to us for a bottle of ketchup and we would say, well, we have tomatoes and we have spices and we have bottles. So if you buy that from us, we're sure that you can use that appropriately for you to make yourself some ketchup. So what I've been doing is actually setting up some financial demonstration sites with all of our mobile technology and the system integration software that works it so that we can actually demonstrate an actual bottle of ketchup to them to actually show them how it actually works for them. I've worked at the Huntington Bank, CompuServe, Cisco. I'm 57 years old, and for the purposes of this presentation, probably the most important fact about me is that I have not worked, I have not been hired by anyone who I had not previously worked for since 1996. So that's almost 20 years. So that's going to be a little bit something for us to think about. So that's enough about me. We're going to talk mostly about you today. So raise your hand if you lead people. Okay? Raise your hand if you want to lead people. All right? Raise your hand if you are going to be at least 50 years old in the year 2030. Are you going to be at least 50 years old in 2030? All right, so that gives me the context. So answer these questions for yourself. And if you don't have people that you lead, think of it as someone who you work with very closely and who you depend on and whose capabilities you rely on to achieve your results. Is there anyone working for you right now who you would feel comfortable working for? Okay, think about that. Do you know the next step job goal for every person who works for you? Do you have a plan that you discuss with them at least every quarter to get those people to that next job goal? Does every person work for you know how their daily work fits in with the company goals and that plan? And if I approached any of your people with any of these questions, would they have the slightest idea what I was talking about? Or would they get suspicious as to why I was asking? Okay? If you answered no to any of those questions, you've got some work to do in terms of developing your future job network. Okay? In Carnegie, what we say is, as a leader, to get results and to grow your people. You have two jobs. No matter what your job is, whether it's in hardware, whether it's in software, well, regardless of what the scope and the nature and the level of the job you have, you only have two jobs. You need to get the results that you're in charge of, and you grow your people. Okay? Back in the 60s, who remembers the light beer commercials where they said, tastes great and less filling? I was going to use that, but it seemed a little bit strange. So there would be one group of guys that say, the beer tastes great, and another bunch of guys that says, no, the beer is less filling. Well, that was actually a riff off of a commercial, cereal commercial from the 50s. And that commercial was, it's good, but it's also good for you. So growing your people now more than ever is not only good for driving the results that you have to drive, but it's also good for you, too, because it sets up your future job network. Okay? Let's provide some context. Who here was out of work in 2009? Okay? Who was out of work for at least 6 months in 2009? Okay? If you go back and look at the history of the world's employment since 1900, the world has a major financial crisis that leads to massive unemployment about every 25 years. Okay? Great Depression of the 1930s, we all understand that. Something that's less well understood is that in the mid to late 1950s, so many of the guys who had come back from the war had been trying to re-enter the job market for so long that there was almost zero employment growth, and in many cases, because of women who left the workforce and the shutdown of the war industries of the time, there was actually negative employment in this country in the late 1950s. Who remembers 1982? Deinflation under Ronald Reagan after years of hyperinflation under Jimmy Carter. Negative job growth in 1982. 2008, okay? Banking crisis. Massive numbers of people laid off. If you applied for a job in 2008, let me tell you what it was like, because I was out at that time. I had saw a job for a small avionics firm in Texas called Victory Avionics. And I didn't know it at the time, but they were actually building a lot of the advanced avionics for the drone program. Okay, they had posted a job in their website for a guy with 30 years experience managing technologists. So I had applied, and I hadn't heard for about 2 months. So I didn't, you know, it was with all the other things that I had applied for. I didn't think about it too much. Got a call from a headhunter in Buffalo. And the guy said, "You're on my list for this job at Victory Avionics." And I said, "Man, it's been a long time since you guys called me. I had written you off." And he said, "We had 40,000 applications for the job." He said, "That's why I'm in Buffalo." He said, "They farmed it out to almost every headhunting firm they can find in batches of 1,000. And you're in my batch of 1,000. Okay? Well, why does this happen? So we know that every 25 years, the world economy is going to lose its mind. Okay? And what usually happens in history is that companies start to dump a lot of their senior planners, their senior strategy people, and their senior functional leaders because of salary. Okay? Who here is familiar with Maslow's triangle? Right? The old sociology thing that says at the bottom is get food and at the top is, you know, be good to God kind of thing, right? So Maslow's triangle is a continuum of human behavior. And what Maslow said is that in times of crisis, what does everybody do? They concentrate on getting food. Okay? Well, companies are very, very much dominated by Maslow's triangle. So there was huge dumping of senior functional leaders in 2008, of which I was one. Okay? There became this concept of good enough quality in continuing operations. In other words, I'm going to survive by the contracts and the business lines that I have in force. Okay? I am not going to really worry about R&D. I'm not going to worry about the next generation of products. In the last 4 years, what do we think the most innovative new product has been in the last 4 years? Enhancements to mobile technology have been good. Can we have another? Well, maturation of the internet, but, you know, Al Gore thinks that started in Tennessee when he walked by the room with ARPANET. Any other huge innovations? Bitcoin is an interesting idea. That's a good one. Now, previous 5 years, name innovations in the previous 5 years, prior to 2008. smartphones, new web design methods, the ability to design with one program once, deploy multiple times across multiple form factor devices. What happened to computing power in the period 2000 to 2008 as a function of form factor? Went up by a factor of four probably, okay? You talk about SaaS, grid computing for SaaS, and the new emergence of high volume business intelligence. My son is a doctoral student at the University of Washington in Seattle, and his doctoral thesis is on divining statistics from sample sets of over a trillion. Okay. Everybody hear about the NSA? Everybody knows about the NSA kickup, right? All right. Think about how much data that is. All right. So if you think about everything that happened in the 5 years prior to 2008 to the five years after 2008, innovation was not really on the burner. Formal investment in people sagged. Going to conferences that were paid by your company became almost unheard of, especially in the financial services industry. Many leaders quit that it's good for you too part of the cereal commercial. They only focused on functional goals. They kind of quit giving time to having regular updates with their staff about how they were performing, mostly because everybody was working 60 hours a week to make up for the lack of staff that had been let go. Okay? And I shouldn't have done that. Many did not quit, but found a way to continue. And we're going to talk about that here in a second. At this point, can we agree that the last 4 years have been challenging? Who thinks the last 4 years have been challenging? Okay. Do we agree that we have a new level of innovation that we need to engage in? Yes, we do. Do we agree that if we help that innovation, it won't only be good for us short term, but long term? It'll also be good for us long term because it'll build our job network. The inevitable pendulum swing is occurring. Companies are starting to ask themselves, why leave all the good marketing opportunities to Google? Okay? Why leave all the good marketing opportunities to the people who didn't quit innovating? Most companies in the U.S. are playing catch-up to fill the innovation, and almost every last one is failing because a lot of the underpinnings of their staffs that they would have been developing over the last 5 years to do the innovation and to have the culture of innovation have waned. This is the point where I also always like to tell an interesting story about my grandfather. My grandfather actually would have been about 30 during the Depression. So he went through the Depression as a young man with a family. And I always noticed that my grandfather had two lists of people. There was a short list of people, which you could not say anything bad about these people. And then there was a large, very much larger list of people where you couldn't say anything good about them. And I never really understood that. So I went to him one day when I was older and had started a family of my own. And I said, what's the difference between these two lists of people? And he said, the people who were on the short list stood by my side and kept their ethics and their sense of community when it was dark. He said, these were guys when I called them on the phone and I needed something in 1931, answered the phone. These are the people who their wives fed the unemployed off their back porch in the evening. These are guys who I would take to war with me. So no matter what has happened since then or anything else, these are people who I know. If I'm in a crisis and I can turn around, they're going to be standing there. The other list of people is just a bunch of guys. Having gone through a similar kind of a situation over the last 4 years, I now have two lists of guys. Okay? I have a lot of guys who I called who did not answer their phone. People who I thought I could depend on. I called another list of guys, some of whom maybe didn't even like me all that well, but who had worked for me, and they answered the phone. And they said, we know you can drive results. We know you can grow your people. We've got some limited capability. We're going to give you what we can because we know you're the kind of guy that we want to have working for us. So the whole objective in investing in the growth of your people is to get on that first list. The more first lists that you are on, when the inevitable time comes, when you're going to need to make those phone calls, the better off that you're going to be. Because those are the people who are going to answer the phone. And they're going to know that you can drive that capability. Now, even in good times, who here works for a company that's 50 people or less? Who here works for a company that's 100 or less? 1,000 or less? All right. Even in, we may not talk all that much about this, but many of you, if you're in smaller startups, face what I kind of call a corollary problem. And that is that there may not be the human resources available because everybody's answering the mail and doing everything else. You know, in a small company, even the president goes to the mailbox, right? Because everybody's totally invested in the mission, okay? If you're in that kind of a situation, it can be very, very difficult to carve out time to think about the needs of the people who you lead. But even in that circumstance, if you invest in your people and align them to the mission of your organization, make sure there's no confusion, especially when you're going fast. Make sure they keep up with all the changes, especially when things are changing. Then you're going to optimize the results that you're going to drive, and you're going to get on their first list. You're going to build that trust with them to where they know that even in challenging circumstances, when time is short, for whatever reason, because you're small, because you've cut back on people, because you've doubled up the work, that sort of thing, they're going to see you still take the time to invest in them, share your experiences, try to put them on the right projects that grow their skills, try and put them in places of success. They're going to see you do that, and you're going to get on their first list. All right, we're going to take a few minutes, and we're going to write a couple things down. So everybody get out a piece of paper or a digital device that you can write on. I didn't think about this, but I got to start saying, or a notepad or something. What I want you to do is think about the following. Who in my group can I groom to one day be my boss? So everybody right there, see that person's face in your mind and say, who in my group could I start to groom to one day be my boss? Somebody who I want to be there when I make that telephone call in the future. All right. Now, once you have the person identified, write down what you think are the top critical things that they would need to improve on before you would want them to be your boss. Okay? So again, this is about you. All right? So think about, this is the person that's going to be your boss. So think about the 3-5 critical issues, the things that they need to be able to be your boss. Now, beside each one, write down whether you can help them overcome each of those issues. Just yes or no. This is an assessment of your own skills. Okay? So let me give you a person who has worked for me in the past. Frank Vallone was a young guy who worked for me at CompuServe back in the day. Frank was very concerned about being seen as a technical specialist. And he had a tendency to avoid things like speaking engagements and this kind of stuff. Not because he was afraid. He was actually a very good speaker. He could just talk your ear off about anything. But he felt that it diminished him as a technical resource. He thought it somehow fluffified him, for lack of a better term, in some way. So Frank was very jealous about being seen as sort of like this super geek. And so what I work on with him is trying to get him to understand that presentation skills and human skills and the other part of what he would need to grow as an individual were important, not only just from a people standpoint, but in terms of communicating back to his clients what he was building. I went to him and I said, Frank, if you can't talk to anybody, how are you going to know that what you're building is what they want or relates to the goals of what you're building it for? So you have to develop these people skills. So you have to think about what do they need and can you give them the experiences? Now, for each of those people and for each of those things where you said, no, I can't help them, write down what you think the reason is. Either I don't have access to the money to do it, I don't have access to the time to do it. Maybe I don't even have the skills to do it. Maybe I don't feel like I have the skills to actually teach someone who reports to me to be my boss. Now, once you've done that, say, is there a company beneficial accommodation that I can make to make that reason go away? Okay. Let's say I'm working for a very small company and I've got a guy who really needs to learn how to debrief successes so that the reasons for the success can be understood by his coworkers so that you can do what with that? If you have a guy who's really good about debriefing successes to his coworkers, what starts to happen? Anybody? What does the rest of the workforce start to do? It starts to emulate that behavior, and you get more successes. All right, say that with me. It starts to emulate that behavior, and you get more successes. If I get more successes, what do I get? More results. And if I get more results, I've done my job. Because my job is what? Let's review. What two things comprise my job? I do two things. What are the two things I do, regardless of what my job is? Two things. Get results and grow people. No matter where you are in your organization, that's the only two things that you're responsible for. Okay? Get results and grow people. So it's not only good to help Frank or the guy who works for you talk about successes. It's also good for you. Okay? Now, here's the important part. And if you don't have a tight relationship with your staff, this can be the tough part, okay? You need to go to your staff member and you have to validate this with them. Because just because you think it true doesn't mean that they agree with it. All right? So if you're going to get your staff member totally involved in seeing how some of their needs relate not just to the success of the company, that's good, but also to their future success, to potentially one day be able to be your boss, then that's good for you too. Okay? Who here thinks if you went to your staff members with a bunch of things and things that you wanted them to work on, how would they react? How many people would their staff members go screaming naked from the room? Okay, thank you for being honest. All right, thank you for being honest. I think some of us, if we haven't really reached out to our staffs in a long time, you would see that they probably run screaming naked from the room. Who thinks that they would be suspicious but would still listen? Suspicious but still listen. Who thinks that they would see this as a genuine attempt on your part to raise their game for their benefit? And who thinks this is just another ploy to get more work out of them for the benefit of the company? Okay, show me the hands. All right, everybody, I got to get your hands up. All right, okay. All right, so you have to be a little careful with this because this can really backfire on you, okay? And if you haven't had a history of talking to your people on a regular basis about skill development of themselves, then this can be a little daunting. So you have to kind of ease your way into this if you haven't done this. 99.999999 times out of 100, when you meet with your people in their annual review, to talk about their skills or at any time in between, what do you normally talk about instead?
Project status.
Okay. Somehow we supplant project status discussions for skill development discussions. Here's a more important question. This is the totally different part where we're going to switch up a little bit. When you meet with your boss about your personal development, what does the discussion usually end up about? Go ahead. Project status, I meant many times, okay? So all of this that you're doing for your people, you should also be managing up to your boss. Okay? You should be using the argument that I am one of the most valuable human resources that you have, and just like you wouldn't let your server still be a generation 2008 device, and you want the most powerful server to be running your e-commerce site, you really shouldn't expect me to be delivering you the kind of results and growing my people the way I should be if I haven't had any mentoring or development since 2008. Who here would pay top dollar for a 1972 Toyota? Nobody, okay? Because for the exact same price that a Toyota was in 1972, you could get one that was plugged into the internet and washes itself and parks itself and all that sort of thing that's happened in the time in between. So one of the biggest challenges that we have as technical people is we're confronted with what I call the great conundrum. We will spend almost any amount of money to get the latest doodad, whether it's a server, an operating system, a programming package, a piece of technology. We love it. We think that it's indicative to what we do, but we have trouble talking about the things that make the difference in our company, and that's the people who wield those things. How skillful are they? How bought into our company corporate policy are they? Do we really see our people as capable things that are really at the heart of driving our business? And why would we buy an extra server, but we won't sit down and spend 30 minutes improving the integration of that person with the missions of the organization? It's a great conundrum. And it's something that we keep doing over and over and over again. So, safely, and this is where the caveat comes. Safely, if you don't have a staff that's going to be running naked from the office, if you do it, start to do this with your people. Start to validate with them not just how they feel about the functions that they're delivering, but do they think they're growing? Especially in the discipline that you guys are in within IT. There's a lot of people who are looking to grow in terms of their functional skills and in terms of their position. I got $5 right now that says there's at least one person who you depend on for your results who's looking for a better gig right now. $5 right now. Okay? If you are not meeting with that individual, whether that's a peer that you depend on, or whether that's someone who works for you that you depend on, you are going to be blind as to why that person is looking. And it may not be money. It may not be something that you can't fix. It might be something that you could fix very easily if you knew about it. Question, are more people killed by trains or cancer? Cancer. Why are more people killed by cancer than trains? What's the difference? One you know is coming and one you don't. You always see the train. You always see the train. So if one of your key performers is going to leave and walk into your office one day and you're going to get blindsided, it's going to be probably because you did not take the time to invest in that person and see the train. You have to see the train coming. Another reason to do this. All right. How am I doing? Oh, I'm doing pretty good. All right, a final few things about you before we open it up to some serious discussion. All right, can we agree that to do this for your folks shows an advanced level of understanding of your company's goals and how best to use the resources given to you to make those goals happen? Can we agree on that? Everybody who's agreeing, can we agree? If your boss sees you doing this, and all of a sudden your results start to go up, is that a good thing for you? That's a good thing for you. If you start meeting with your people and you start reinforcing not just what the goal of the department is in terms of your functional targets, but you seriously talk about the things that you need as people to be able to deliver it more efficiently, is your boss going to notice that? Is the value of giving you those resources to manage going to go up? Is the return on investment of those people going to go up? Indeed it is. Can we agree that if you do this over your entire career, that it will also make you a better functional deliverer of these outcomes? Practice makes what? Practice makes perfect. If I can do this for 10 people, and I do it for 5 years from 10 people, my ability to do it for 100 people does what? It increases. It goes up. If I do it for 100 people for 5 years, my ability to do it for 1,000 people goes up. Okay? If I learn how the different, if I then am thinking about the difference in doing it for 10 people as opposed to doing it for 1,000 people, what happens to my personal efficiency? It goes up. Those are two different, I've done both those jobs. I've led 10 people and I've led 1,000 people. Those are two different things. Principles are the same, but the way that you spread yourself and the processes and the things that you do to do that are not the same. And you only learn that by working your way through the scaling problems that go from 10 people to 1,000 people. And finally, can we agree that if you get this experience, the people who have been impacted most by it and seen the positive impact you achieve from doing it will one day want you on their team? We agree with that? Whenever there's a new CEO or a CIO at a company, happens quite frequently, so Bob is now the new CIO of a company. He's going to spend 6 months before he does anything visible. What does he do for that first six months? He learns the company culture. What other two things does he learn? Finds the key players. Very good. What else does he learn? He learns, well, I'll give you one of them. Well, I'll give you one of the two. He learns what works. And then what else does he learn? He learns what doesn't work. Now, as Bob traverses his new organization, and he's boogieing through the organization, having his staff meetings and reinforcing everyone's feeling about the company and stuff, as he finds things that are not working, what does he see in his mind? Who does Bob see in his mind as he finds things that aren't working? You know who it is. What does he see in his head? He sees a picture of a person in his head who he knows could make this work. That's what Bob sees. Okay, so as Bob is boogieing his way through the organization and he starts to see the things that don't work, he starts to get these flashes of mental images of people from his background who he knows can fix that problem. Okay, everybody knows Gordon Gekko, greed is good, right? Greg Girard, nepotism is good. Okay, nepotism is good because it comes from an experiential understanding that once I know what the problems are, I have in my head the guy who can fix that for me. And who potentially can fix that for me in the context of this new culture that I've come into. Someone else said that we learn about the culture, and that's true. There's guys that you know in your past who can come in and fix that that you know you're not going to bring because it would be like turning a bull loose in a China shop and create all kinds of horrible things. But you do get that. So what's the third? What's the last thing that Bob does as he wanders his way through finding high performers, finding what works, finding what doesn't work? So after he sees those snapshots of those people, what else is he doing? And who's at the top of those organizations? Those people he's bringing in, or the high performers. All right. He's going to start to realign this company. He's going to quit doing some stuff. We always quit doing stuff we don't need to do. Generating 7,000 pages of printed reports because we've just always done that. So we get rid of that stuff first. But we've found these high performers. And these high performers are not only functional high performers, but they're what kind of high performers? Two jobs, get results, grow people. These are people who are also influencers. These are people who, if he walked into a room and said, Bob Jr. is a high performer, everybody's going to go, oh yes, Bob Jr., he's a high performer, absolutely, yes, okay. Because everybody knows that Bob Jr. is a high performer. He's not just, you know, locked in a closet, we throw food in every so often, and he produces operating systems. He goes out there and he tells people what's going on and how it works, and he's lifting all the other boats and maximizing our success. So that's what Bob does as he walks the hall. If you want to survive a reorg at your company, what should you be? A high performer. Because Bob is going to see you, and he's going to say, ooh, Warner's a high performer. And then he's going to say that to other people. Do you think Warner's a high performer? And they go, oh, yeah, Warner, he's a high performer. Okay? So that's the way to survive a reorg. And it's also good for your career, longer term. So, go do it. There really isn't any reason on that list of things that your people need that can't be overcome by your personal investment of time. Because when you look at that list, I think that what you're going to find is, in many cases, one of the biggest reasons that those people couldn't be your job today is they don't have the experience. You know, the Navy has two different kinds of guys. There are staff guys who talk to Congress and, you know, generate reports and that kind of stuff. And then there's what they call blue water sailors. Okay? The member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from the Navy is always a guy who, which side is he on? Which is he? He's a blue water sailor. There's never a guy in the Navy that's going to be on the Joint Chiefs of Staff who hasn't had probably combat experience on a ship on the water. And why is that? I know the practical problems. I've seen what works. I've seen what doesn't work. Maybe I've been sent or had to send somebody into a situation where the possibilities of coming back aren't so hot. And I've had to make that case to those people. I've had to talk about different kinds of situations and experiences that you don't get any other way. So another thing that you're doing here is you're trying to make everybody in your group a blue water sailor. Next best to actually putting them on the water is to have you in a meaningful way that's direct and personal to them, tell them what that experience is. Say, we were in this situation and this is what we had to do. What's even better is give your people thought problems. If you have people who have experiential issues and you don't happen to have a project that's going to raise their game in terms of their experience, give them a thought problem and say, how would we do this? How would we do that? If we found ourselves in this situation, how would we do that so that we were more profitable, more efficient, and more effective? If you start asking those questions, you're building the skills of the people, but what else are you getting? All kinds of free ideas. All kinds of free ideas from people who are on the line who can really potentially bring you a perspective that maybe you spent too many board meetings or whatever it is that you've been doing to really know. It gives you a look at blue water sailing that maybe you didn't see before because of some of your experiences, and it builds your capability quiver. So, to review, it's good. It's good for you. And if you could go ahead to the year 2031, after the world has lost its mind again, okay, and one-third of the workforce is out of work, and you are not, because you got people who say, this guy's on my short list. I got to have him on my team. I got to survive this. I got to have this guy. If you would go ahead to 2031, your future self would say, thank you for spending the time. Okay? Thank you for getting me on those short lists. Thank you for making me someone that someone knows that when the chips are down, they can turn around and I'll be there. And that I can function and that I can perform. So that's the end of the formal presentation. Questions? Go ahead. Well, I think that that's a little bit, that's a very good question considering the audience. Do you rely on someone to get drive your results, a coworker or another department? Yes. You can do that, but another thing is to pick people in your organization who are younger and who might be wanting to move into a different discipline that you know about and mentor them with no potential of any benefit to you. That's even a bigger bag of trust. When Carnegie, we talk about building the bag of trust for when you need it, right? If you help your own people, that builds you a certain amount of trust in your bag of trust. But if you start searching out just random guys in your organization who maybe look at you as a if you're a technical expert in something, and maybe they're in another division and they might want to get that from you, if you actually set up a mentoring program for yourself or even give the idea to your organization. When I was at CompuServe, I set up a mentoring program for the young guys. And the rule was you can only mentor people who didn't report to you. When I was at the Huntington, if you mentor someone who doesn't report to you, what's the potential you're going to talk about project status? None, okay? So when you schedule that hour and you walk in that room, you are only talking about skills. Because there's no projects in the way, okay? When I was at the Huntington, I set up a mentoring program. The one rule was you couldn't mentor anybody who talked to you. When I was at BMW Financial Services, I set up a mentoring program, and the rule was you can't mentor anybody who reports to you. So you gain the practice in the way that you can. The important thing is that you're showing that you're making a personal commitment to the organization to the developmental needs of the people in it. That's really the key thing. Any other questions? All right, it's been a lot of fun. I always enjoy this topic. I hope you found it a little bit thought-provoking, maybe something a little different, something that you don't think about every day when you think about career development. And if you have any questions, Warner has my email address, and I'd be perfectly glad to help you out because I want to be on your short list too. I want to be on your list of people that you can trust. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.